Community radio in your city.
This is Cambridge 105.
Welcome to Cambridge 105's election studio with me, Sam Davis. Our aim for the show is to give you a real insight into the personalities and the policies of the candidate standing for election as your MP in either the Cambridge City or the South Cambridgeshire constituencies. Last week, we finished our review of the contest for the South Cams constituency and started to look at the prospects for Cambridge City with Green Party candidate Rupert Reid. And we take that a bit further today with my first interviewee, the Conservative Party candidate, Shamali Fernando.
Shamali Fernando is seeking to better the second place achieved by the Cambridge Conservative candidate 5 years ago. Born in the East Midlands, her father, Shamal, ran for the SDP in the 1983 and 1987 elections. And when she first entered politics, Miss Fernando became a Liberal Democrat. She sought the Lib Dem nomination to stand for London Mayor in 2007, but 2 years later joined the Conservatives. A barrister, she qualified at the Inns of Court School of Law in 2002, and in 2012 was sworn in as a licensed attorney for the State Bar of New York. Her legal skills have been put to the test during the campaign, threatening her Lib Dem opposite number Julian Huppert with legal action over remarks that may or may not have been made about wearing of wristbands by mental health patients. The misattributed comments and subsequent violent threats led her to close her Twitter account that bore the handle Whereis007. Today, Shamali Fernando is in the Cambridge 105 election studio.
Welcome to Cambridge 105, Shamali.
We've got
a lot to cover in the next 25 minutes or so because there are several policies issues that I'd like to discuss with you. But I think most of our listeners will be aware there's also been some particular personal dimensions to the campaign so far, and I know listeners are curious about it. So can we start by getting the whole wristband saga out of the way? And maybe you can tell me your feelings about how it's come to dominate the agenda for the last 2 weeks.
Thank you very much, Sam, for the opportunity to come and talk to you and also your listeners at Cambridge 105. It's great to be back here. I did one of my first interviews as the candidate in Cambridge with Cambridge 105, and I believe it was Julian Clover who was the presenter at the time. On the issue of comments made and comments attributed to me, you will have seen the latest in the press, which is that both the Lib Dem candidate and the blogger have retreated from their original position, and there is a process to be followed. You know, I've been a barrister for 12 years. The way I see it, you can't get away with making statements, defamatory statements against someone, and then not apologising for them and not seeking to correct them. So whilst they've retreated from their position and said, well, no, I never heard her say that, or I don't recall her saying that, she wasn't talking about a compulsory scenario for mental health sufferers, it is pretty poor the tactics that people will stoop to in an election. And we've all signed up for a Clean Pledge campaign. It has been breached several times even before we signed up. There was literature from different parties condemning other parties, negative campaigning, which really isn't the spirit of Cambridge. And I have found by running a positive campaign that we have actually been able to articulate these are our policies in the Conservatives. This is what Shamali Fernando is about, and this is what Shamali Fernando aims to do. So in respect of the pending litigation, there is a process and it'll just have to go through lawyers.
Okay, well, that's very clear. Thank you for making such a definitive statement there. I think some people were surprised that you went down the route of having a legal challenge about this because they assumed that as a barrister, you'd have to develop a pretty thick skin over the years. And I know that Julian Huppert took a lot of flack himself in his first couple of years in Parliament. And I guess the question is, doesn't it just go with the territory?
I think for me, as a barrister and as a human being, I've prided myself on my integrity, and my reputation is what I have, and what I bring to this campaign is my integrity and reputation. And for that to be damaged in the way that it has done, you know, this news went viral. It went to places as far as Australia, Canada, the Times of India picked it up. And the other thing is, it's not just harm to me. There are thousands of mental health sufferers out there who suddenly thought, my goodness, you know, are we really being asked to do this? Is this a proposal for us for the future? And it caused them harm as well. So I had emails at the outset which were from very vulnerable people in society, explaining their position. And, you know, I had to respond to each of those emails one at a time, explaining my position and that I hadn't said what I was accused of saying. So the damage that was caused by a candidate making mental health a political football and by a blogger seizing an opportunity to get his name in the press or whatever he wanted to achieve out of the process. And he was gloating actually at a hustings about how the press had been in touch with him, the various different newspapers. And it would have been fine if I'd said it. And, you know, if I had said something wrong, then of course I would have apologised. But I knew, and I'm in a job where, particularly as a barrister, you pride yourself in your ability to speak candidly but accurately. And, you know, as a barrister, I get paid to talk. So it's part of the profession. It goes with that territory. And I think when you come into politics, yes, you do put yourself in the public spotlight. You can fall foul of situations, and you can be in a situation where the public want to put you under intense scrutiny. And I think that's where your reputation is so important. And that's why, for me, the reason I am... you know, the reason I consulted lawyers is because my integrity is at stake.
All right. Well, let's park wristbandgate and and move on to some more substantial matters. And goodness knows there's enough to talk about. Can we start with the economy?
Of course.
So a lot of your party's pitch to the voters is based on the Conservatives' superior economic credibility, if you like. On Thursday, the IFS reported that in common with problems with many parties' financial calculations, they'd found a $30 billion black hole in the Conservative spending plans for the next government, even if you raise another £10 billion from welfare cuts and £5 billion from better dealing with tax avoidance. So I know the IFS is a body rather than, a definitive body, if you like, and I'm sure it's possible to pick holes in their findings, but doesn't that general line of thought somewhat undermine Conservative claims of superior economic probity?
No, I think what we're asking people to do is judge us on our track record. We have gone from having the worst recession since 1931, at the time we took office, to being the fastest growing economy in Europe. And we have demonstrated that on a daily basis, we're creating 1,000 jobs. Now, that's not David Cameron going out and handing out a job to 1,000 people. That is by having confidence in our economy and balancing the books so that business feels, right, actually, you know what, I can expand. I can take on new staff. I can pay more. And we have seen 760,000 new jobs start up, new businesses start up since we took office. Again, that's people having the confidence to say, well, actually, the economic climate looks good. I'll start up a new company. And we're very fortunate here in Cambridge. We have seen 5 new startups since 2010 that have gone on to become billion-dollar companies. That's quite an achievement. So in terms of the IFS findings, we've also seen the IFS report only a few months ago that living standards have improved for people, in their view. And you will always find statistics, I think the phrase is lies, and statistics, or damn lies. And you will always find someone to argue for and against. And what we have to do as a government, we know that these are the savings we want to make, these are the areas that we're going to make them in. But it's also about raising taxes through more and more people paying income tax by the very fact that more and more people will be working, and also more corporations and businesses paying tax by the sheer fact of the sheer number and volume of people starting new businesses.
You mentioned confidence, business confidence, clearly a big factor. There's been lots of media coverage of big businesses saying that they're unhappy with the uncertainty that a in-out EU referendum will generate for them. And, you know, for example, HSBC have said this morning that they're thinking about moving their headquarters from the UK, and the possibility of a referendum is not the only reason, but it's certainly one of the reasons they mentioned. Did David Cameron, do you think, put internal party politics ahead of the national interest in agreeing to the referendum?
No, I don't think so at all. And I think it's very prevalent in Cambridge. You can be in Petersfield or Market and you will not hear issues of immigration. You will not hear issues of a referendum on the doorstep. But just step out a few further miles to places like Cherry Hinton, King's Hedges, Arbury, and there you will find the views on immigration and an EU referendum are very polarised. So my generation has never voted on Europe. I'm 36 years old, and people younger than me obviously have never voted on Europe. I think maybe the time is right to be able to have our say and ventilate these issues, decide what's important for our country, have a stronger position in Europe. I would like to see this country stay in Europe, but in a renegotiated Europe, one where Britain is stronger.
It's interesting that you talk about different views even within different wards in this constituency. My understanding is that the latest polls suggest that you are struggling to gain traction with the electorate. I think the last Lord Ashcroft poll put you at around 16% compared to 26%, which the 2010 candidate achieved. And more than that, in each of the 2001, 2005 and 2010 elections, the Conservatives in Cambridge got about 10% less of the vote than the party achieved nationally. That, I hope that explanation makes sense. So why is it that in Cambridge, which is a city that's boomed like virtually no other in the last decade, and which has, you know, very low unemployment, why is it moving away from the Conservative Party rather than towards it?
A couple of things. If we take the Lord Ashcroft poll, he only polled 1,000 people out of term time for students. And yesterday, Varsity released a poll which said that actually the Lib Dem share of the vote among students had dropped dramatically. And it was it is Labour and the Conservatives that are neck and neck among students. So you get different sectors of the population. So that's among students. That's where we are neck and neck. On the doorstep, what we're finding is there are a lot of people who have pledged to be Conservative, but were considering voting tactically. And they did vote tactically last time to keep Labour out, so they voted Lib Dem. And we have found, actually, there are over, I think the figure is 4,038 households, where some households have up to five people, from our canvassing, where people last time voted Lib Dem just to keep Labour out. What we're saying to people is, if you believe in the Conservative values, if you subscribe to Conservative Party policy, vote for what you believe in. The Conservatives came second in Cambridge in the general election of 2010. And ultimately, the poll that really matters is what happens on polling day.
Well, absolutely. I guess, you know, having followed local politics over the last few years, It does seem that you have a bit of a hill to climb, though. I mean, the Conservatives only have one seat on the City Council. And although the County Council is Conservative-led, I'm not sure that does you any favours, because they seem to make a lot of decisions which are contrary to the interests and the desires of people in the city. So to take one example, starting to introduce charging at park and ride sites. Now, that may play very well with more rural voters, but I would imagine the consequences of that could be relatively unpopular in the city. So I know as an MP you're one step removed from those sorts of decisions, but are you frustrated because you think the county council dynamic is actually creating more of a barrier for you?
Couple of things that you've raised. So one, in terms of where we stand today, the demographics of Cambridge are more in our favour. You touched on that in your earlier question very slightly. In terms of bigger business has come to Cambridge. The science, the technology clusters, they're all flourishing in Cambridge, which is attracting more people who are of a conservative mindset to Cambridge. In terms of the achievements of the County Council, we have seen the city deal, which has secured £1 billion in funding for Cambridge. Now, my personal view is £1 billion is not enough. We heard a few days ago in the Cambridge cycling campaign hustings from a gentleman in the audience who said that it cost £1 billion to build the Shard in London. And we're trying to achieve quite a lot of things with that $1 billion in Cambridge. Now, it's a piecemeal stream of funding.
It's conditional on achieving certain growth targets, yes?
Spot on. And if our growth is not sustainable, if it's not shown to be sustainable development, then we don't meet the target to be able to get the next instalment of 200 million and thereafter the final 100 million. So the city deal comprises 500 million over a period of years, with local actors also putting in 500 million. But that's something secured under a Conservative government led by the Conservative County Council. So that's a good achievement. We've also seen broadband rolled across Cambridgeshire by the Conservative County Council. And more recently, in terms of cycle paths on Huntingdon Road, those are under the remit of the County Council. We do have a problem in Cambridge in terms of who is responsible for what.
Don't we just?
So housing and education might come under the City Council, but transport comes under the County Council. And the electorate on the 7th of May will be living in the city of Cambridge, but won't be able to vote on issues such as street lighting because that's under the remit of the County Council. I think it's a time for tribal politics to cease. I would like to see the councils working much closer together, sharing resources, pooling together ideas, and really taking on board the opinions of local people. And I think Cambridge has struggled as a result of the tribal nature of politics between the two councils.
All right, well, let's pause there on the heavy stuff. And I've warned you that we're going to be doing this one-minute round. Yeah. So off we go. Describe yourself in three words.
Fun, committed, and determined.
What's your proudest achievement in any walk of life?
There's so many. that I think every year I say to myself, do something new, better and bigger than you did the year before. And that's the message I would echo to those who are younger than me. In fact, those who are older than me, we never stop learning in life. And so every year I try and do something new. And I guess this is the first time I'm being a parliamentary candidate. So this is probably the most exciting time of my life this year. A couple of years ago, I qualified as an attorney for the New York State Bar. So every year I'm constantly looking at what's the next challenge that I can achieve.
If you had to go for a drink with the leader of one of the other parties, who would you choose and why?
Plaid Cymru.
Oh, interesting.
I can't remember the lady's name.
Leanne Wood, isn't it?
Leanne Wood, that's right. I have found from the television debates that she seems a very sincere person to me in politics. And I think I'd like to get to know her a little better because I think she actually believes what she stands for.
The implication of that is that other people don't. But we will park that thought. What's your guilty pleasure?
I like chocolate.
You and just about everybody else who sat in that chair. And the mum's net question, what's your favourite biscuit?
I think it has to be chocolate hobnobs.
You sounded like I was dragging that piece of information out of you. All right, go back to the policy stuff. Housing. That's pretty critical and pretty contentious in terms of the quantity that should be built, the locations in which it should be built, and the siphoning off of a large volumes of housing stock into buy-to-let or even buy-to-leave arrangements. And this statistic that 30% of new builds in Cambridge are sold to foreign investors. Are the electorate right to be voicing some unhappiness about that pattern?
Yes, in terms of foreign purchases and then those properties not being occupied or rented out at a high rate to residents of Cambridge, there is an issue. And I would actually like to champion legislation which ensures that a developer is forced to release phase one of that development domestically. At the moment, you can go along to a developer and ask about properties that they've got coming onto the market, and you'll be told that they've already released these properties in Singapore, there's buyers from Hong Kong, 40% of the development is gone, even before you even knew that it was on the market. And that has to stop, because that artificially inflates the housing market, and that's a problem that Cambridge has struggled with. But I feel that that is an area which we can resolve quite quickly with legislation, and either you bring it in through a parity basis so that developers release property domestically and internationally at the same time, or you bring it in with the advantage to domestic purchasers that property is released before it was it is released domestically before it is released internationally. In terms of some of the schemes that we've managed to put in place to help first-time buyers, so we've got the shared ownership scheme that came in under this government, we've got the Help to Buy scheme, and one of the future things that we want to do if we form the next government is to introduce 200,000 new starter homes for people under the age of 40 who will be first-time buyers, giving them the opportunity to buy properties below market value at 20% of a discount.
Education, similarly contentious. Why was a Conservative government, which has consistently lauded Cambridge as an engine of growth for the economy and a model for other parts of the country, why was that government so resistant to the idea of giving Cambridgeshire schools a fairer funding allocation? It was the lowest in the country. We have extracted a £20 million additional allocation, but it's now among the lowest in the country. It doesn't seem much of a reward for the growth that we've generated.
So Cambridge is the global seat of learning, and it has probably the best teachers in the country as a result of there being teacher training opportunities at Cambridge University. Successive governments have actually neglected children in Cambridge, and we have, under this government, been able to allocate £23.2 million of funding for schools in Cambridgeshire. Now, I'm working with an organisation called Cambridge Ahead and also Cambridge Area Partnership, and we believe that we can make the case to government for more funding for our children, where we will not ask for the full 311 to bring us up to the actual national average per child, but actually ask for around £150, because we believe that we've got the resources locally and through groups like Cambridge Ahead to meet the difference.
Last question, and I'm going to need to ask you to be reasonably efficient with your answer to it. I read a quote in The Economist a couple of weeks ago which said, both Labour and Conservative are appealing to voters less on the strength of their plans for Britain than on the basis of what they are not. Do you agree that nationally this is turning out to be a pretty uninspiring and negative campaign?
One thing that troubles me with the national campaign is, of all parties, is that there is pontification by journalists and media organisations as to what the outcome will be. So we detract from actually articulating our own policies. I have tried here in Cambridge to focus, as I say, on a Clean Pledge campaign, a very positive campaign, getting our message across to the people of Cambridge. So I can't really speak for what's on the national agenda in terms of how we campaign nationally, but we have in the Conservative Party laid our stall out to bear. This is what we stand for, this is what we are fearful of, and here in Cambridge, I'm just putting out there, this is what we stand for.
All right, well, thank you very much for coming in to talk to us today.
Pleasure.
To round off, we've asked all of our interviewees to choose a record, and we'd like to know what you've chosen and why.
Well, it has to be Fernando by ABBA, for very obvious reasons.
Can you hear the drums, Fernando? I remember long ago another starry night like this. In the firelight, Fernando, you were humming to yourself and softly strumming your guitar. I could hear the distant drums and sounds of bugle calls were coming from afar. They were closer now, Fernando. Every hour, every minute seemed to last eternally. I was so afraid, Fernando. We were young and full of life, and none of us prepared to die. And I'm not ashamed to say the roar of guns and cannons almost made me cry.
Now, I was hoping to be joined by Patrick O'Flynn, the UKIP candidate for Cambridge, as my second guest today. But unfortunately, he's proved rather elusive. And despite our best efforts, we've not been able to fix up an interview. So instead, we've invited in a prominent recent local convert to the UKIP cause, Nick Clarke, to give us his take on their policies and prospects.
The headline in the Cambridge News declared former county council leader Nick Clarke is back, leading Cambridge Conservatives into the next general election. But as we approach polling day, Mr. Clarke is neither standing for office or backing anyone else's attempts. No longer a member of the Conservative Party, he publicly announced he was joining UKIP. Mr. Clarke lost his Foulbourne seat in May 2013, having been elected as the Cambridgeshire County Councillor in 2009 and elected leader of the council 2 years later. He sat on the committees that included chief execs and leaders from the district councils, police, fire and NHS. He was also a non-executive founding director of a new bank, Cambridge and Counties, the bank jointly owned by the council's pension fund and a Cambridge college. In business, he took SysAdmins from loss into a multi-million pound international IT company. And today, he works with Cambridge United's Community Trust and has time for the golf course whilst looking for the next opportunity. Will that be in the boardroom or in politics?
It's good to have you on Cambridge 105, Nick. And we're delighted that you could make it in. I have to confess to being a little disappointed that Patrick hasn't been more visible in the constituency. And I know that that's provoked a certain amount of comment. Do you think he's got his priorities right? And is it somewhat insulting to the constituency that he hasn't been around more?
Well, thank you, first of all, for inviting me on, Sam. No, I don't think that's the case at all. Patrick has two hats to wear at the moment. One, standing for election here in Cambridge. And two, he's the UKIP national spokesman for economics. And as you'll probably have seen on the TV recently, he's on endless broadcasts and endless programmes. So I think he's trying to compete with those two priorities. I think he's making himself available and visible within Cambridge. But of course, you can't attend all the hustings and all the radio shows all the time. And I think there is the potential that an awful lot of these hustings have the same sort of 200 people that sort of move around the city anyway. So I think it's the right mix at the moment, and I'm sure you'll hear from him in the future.
OK, well, as I say, we are very grateful to you for making yourself available this afternoon. And I must say, it's great to be able to talk to someone who is so steeped in Cambridge politics. You've been active for a long time. Now, you have recently, very recently, made the decision to join UKIP. Can you give us some insight into what drove your decision?
Yes, I can. It's quite a large question, that, actually. It's
we have time.
No simple answer, I'm afraid. But in essence, I lost the confidence that the Conservatives would be in a position or have the will to help this country reclaim its sovereignty in terms of leaving the EU. The party itself is pretty well split between those that wish to stay in the EU and those that don't. And as such, there is no single voice that can campaign for the exit from the EU other than UKIP's. So in that sense, UKIP has a strong, clear and resilient voice that is able to stand up for this country, not just for these elections, albeit they are interesting, but for the following election and the one after that. I'm under no illusion that getting us to leave the EU is a marathon and not a sprint, and people need to hear the arguments on both sides of the camp. At the moment, the exit argument has pretty much been covered up and lost, and the Conservatives don't seem to be able to clarify the arguments. They have offered up a referendum, but I'm afraid I remain unconvinced that their heart is really in that. It's much more about trying to reclaim some of the UKIP votes, I think, that have gone to UKIP. I think the referendum, I'm looking forward to seeing what the wording will be, but I'm hoping it will be fair. I have my doubts whether that be the case. But at the end of the day, I don't see the Conservatives being in a position to lead us out of Europe. On other policies besides Europe, when I was the leader of the County Council, I came into battle with Conservative Central Office on a regular basis. And one of the things I used to battle with them about was local authority funding. We all know that the deficit needs reducing. We know our debts are too high in this country, and I believe in low taxation. But the reduction in funding to local authorities was extreme, and is extreme. And the problem with that is it's not just a policy. It's a policy that directly affects people's lives. We were having to cut back, and I'm sure they're still having to cut back the services for the elderly, for children, for the disabled and the frail. And those people don't have a voice, typically, and it relies upon the local authorities to protect them and look after them as an organisation of last resort. And I know from my own experience of running the council and from colleagues telling me afterwards that that is getting harder and harder. And in fact, it's what drove the Conservatives under my leadership to take the extraordinary step of putting the council tax up in the face of the Conservative Party saying we should not do that. And we did that to protect the old and the vulnerable. And we felt that without that funding, to make up the shortfall from government funding, people are genuinely at risk.
So those are all good reasons. And none of them are particularly new reasons. I mean, the austerity agenda has been there for 5 years. What is it that triggered the decision to jump ship halfway through an election campaign? Because that's a fairly dramatic gesture by any measure.
It is. The 2 points I've raised with you were the largest part of the decision-making process. I have still hoped that the government would be able to reverse some of their funding decisions for local authorities, and there is no sign of that. In fact, it's been made quite clear that the cuts will be even more moving forward. I've stayed out of politics predominantly for the last 2 years, and that says to me that's a decent period to stay out of politics. I have no intention to go into a fight with fellow Conservatives. In fact, I remain friends with them, and they've given me great offers of support, interestingly, since I've moved to UKIP. And I would hope to be recruiting sergeant for a number of them after the election. I've deliberately not stood for election this time round, despite there being opportunities for me to do so, because I didn't want to go head-to-head with former colleagues on this local election and this the parliamentary election. I'm now looking towards the long term. I'm looking for the next 10-year battle to get us out of Europe. And that said to me, when would be the opportunity to make the most impact, to make a statement? And that was probably 2 weeks ago.
Okay. As we both know, there's all kinds of urban myths and derogatory soundbites about UKIP policies. And I've spent lots of time this week trying to go through the manifesto and sort out fact from fiction. And I'm really keen that we use some of the time we have available to us today to go through those key issues and let people hear for themselves what it is that UKIP offers without any suggesting that it's being distorted.
Well, whilst remembering, I've been a member of UKIP for 2 weeks and I don't hold office or any elected position.
Okay, but you, from what you said in answer to the previous question, you've had enough time to think about this to get comfortable with?
Yes, I have.
Okay, great. Well, let's try and proceed on that basis then. I guess, given the depressing, distressing scenes that have been filmed in the Mediterranean this week with, you know, boatloads of immigrants, hundreds of people dying, migration is a pretty pressing area to start the discussion. And it's also one that evokes huge emotion, both pro and against. So can we hear from you in your own words what UKIP's proposals are, how you think they'd work, and why you think they're necessary?
Sure. UKIP are quite clear that they welcome migration. Opponents don't want to hear saying that, but that's a fact. But what they want to do is to welcome migrants on a case-by-case basis, depending on the need of this country. So the plan is to invoke an Australian-style point system for people who wish to come to this country. And that is wholly fair, wholly reasonable. It is good for this country and good for people that we want to come here. The current system that allows unrestricted migration from the EU actually is preventing us bringing migrants to this country from the other parts of the world who we desperately need. If you talk to Cambridge University, they will say that there are people coming here to study and then not being allowed to remain here, having to go back, who then set up businesses and great technology that ends up competing with us. And in fact, I was asked to speak to Vince Cable 2.5 years ago to help relieve some of those pressures. So the current position on migration is that we are a relatively small country. During my lifetime, the population numbers have been in the 40 millions. We're now at 64 million and climbing. And this is all about space. It's not about who is here. It's about space, not race, as the cliche goes. I think there is a bunch of myths that grow up around this. UKIP are accused of all sorts of horrible ideas around this point, which I think are unfair. I think if you have an open policy that says we welcome migration, we want the very best in the world to come here to reinforce our business and our intellectual studies, that is as open as it can be, but it's being distorted at the moment. We'd hear about business wanting to have the free movement of people across Europe. That is true to a point, but it's generally large business that wants that. Small businesses, in fact, are struggling to compete sometimes with a reasonably skilled workforce from Europe, who then undercut the businesses that are here normally. Our young people's opportunities to go in at the bottom rung of a ladder in a company and work their way up appear to be being cut off because those positions are being filled by already skilled people from overseas. And in fact, that really means that we're not investing in our future. So it's not necessarily a simple answer. There is a feeling amongst people when I speak to them, and I feel it myself, that, you know, certainly in the east of England and the southeast, it's just getting very crowded here. Opponents will then come back and say, yes, but migration is good for GDP. It's a little more complicated than that, because, of course, if you have more people doing more activity, of course, the GDP will go up. Does it increase it per capita? Is an open question. But this can't just be about business. It has to be about our way of life and our preservation of our way of life, the way we choose to live. And if it gets too crowded and too busy, and we spend more time in our cars, on the roads, stuck in traffic jams, and we have longer queues for our GPs, and we can't get into the hospitals that we need, and our schools have bigger classrooms, that isn't a way of life that I want to support.
Right, let's park the migration discussion there for now. Is it fair to say that, broadly speaking, UKIP positions itself as the party of the ordinary working man or women? You know, you think about UKIP and you think about Farage in the pub with a pint, with a ciggy, the whole kind of common sense agenda that you say you advocate. That's how it comes across to me, anyway. I assume there's some measure of intention there. I wonder how consistent that image is with the reality of your policies. So, for example, on the economy, I know that your manifesto says that you would have no truck with a mansion tax. None of the parties proposing a mansion tax are looking at that affecting anybody whose house value is less than £2 million. So that's not really ordinary working people. And if you did bring in a mansion tax, then the money that would be derived by the Exchequer could be funded, could be used to fund things like education and housing. I mean, I'm just not sure how joined up the image and the reality of the policies are.
I think there are two separate points there. I think the perception that you have of UKIP being representing ordinary people isn't one that's contrived. I think that's just genuinely what's happening. I think if you talk about the mansion tax, let's also talk about inheritance tax at the same time, because the similar will apply. The reality is that UKIP believe that people who have been hardworking, have earned some money and have benefited from that, should retain it. Inheritance tax and the mansion tax are double taxation. You've already been taxed once to get your cash, and then you'll be taxed again when you either sell your house or you die, and that just doesn't seem innately fair. But look, that is but part one of it. The people who are flocking to UKIP, and that is true, come from all walks of life, from all parties, all walks of life. There are people who have supported Labour all their lives, people who have supported Conservatives, we've had Greens. There are a whole range of different people. And it is something about common sense politics again. It is something about not career politicians. It is something about ordinary people. I mean, I spoke last night to the Hunts and South Cams UKIP branch there. Yeah, just full of ordinary men and women that you would meet anywhere and see normally. My own experience, if I have to be in any way critical of the Conservatives, is that locally, in branch level, similar applies. But you don't have to go very far into central office or into Westminster to find a very different atmosphere. You know, I've been relatively successful in business, but I left school at 16. I'm a very poor background. Parents still live in Cornwall, and where I grew up, in the military, but not as a commissioned officer, as a senior NCO. Was successful in business and then reasonably successful in politics. So coming up the hard way. And that is sort of celebrated by UKIP. Not sure it's in quite the same way by the Conservatives, I have to say.
All right, well, that's probably a good moment to take a pause from the serious stuff. Now, I've warned you, as I've warned all my interviewees, that we're going to do this quickfire round. So I hope you're ready for that.
We'll see.
Could you describe yourself in three words?
Determined, focused, and no nonsense.
Okay. What's your proudest achievement? Any field?
Scoring my first 100 at cricket.
I thought you'd work the cricket in there somewhere. If you had to go for a drink and a chat with one of the leaders of the other parties, who would you go with and why?
Probably Nick Clegg, actually, just so I could provoke him into making a decision one way or the other about something.
What's your guilty pleasure?
Oh, recently, Magnums, the chocolate ice creams.
I wish it was the weather for it rather more often than it has been. And the mum's neck question, what's your favourite biscuit?
Oh, chocolate bourbons.
Okay, there's a real chocolate theme going on here, isn't there?
I know, it shouldn't be, but there is. It's a new thing that's happened to me in the last year.
It's not induced by UKIP affiliations.
No, I think it was a consequence of getting married, actually.
Right, thank you for answering those. Back to the serious stuff. Housing policy. Can't get a lot more serious than that in Cambridge. Your housing policy is to build a lot of homes. A million homes by 2020. Have I got that right?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. That's twice the target of any other party, I think. And you say they'll be on brownfield sites and you'll preserve the green belt. Is that remotely practical?
It is practical, but it'll be a hard ask. I've got no doubts at all about that. But let me just point something out first of all. One of my great concerns from the Labour governments and Conservative governments of the past is that when council houses were sold off, and the right to buy is fine, the receipts didn't go back to the local authorities. They went back to central government. As a consequence, local authorities were not in a position financially to build more. So I think that places like Cambridge in particular have been let down by that policy. And I think receipts need to remain or need to be going back to the local authorities to help alleviate that. Because we talk about low-cost housing and affordable housing. Well, I can tell you now, around Cambridge, there's no such thing, is there? Affordable housing, none of it's affordable for people on modest salaries. So if we're going to meet the needs that exist at the moment, we need to build an awful lot of houses. But, a lot of these houses are needed because, wait for it, people are migrating here. Your net migration in the numbers that we're talking about at the moment per year puts a huge pressure on housing. People have to live somewhere.
You've mentioned the localism agenda, and that comes through in your manifesto. For example, in the context of priority for housing being given to local people and local people having the final say on major planning applications, can I ask what the definition of local is in that context? Because Cambridge City is so clearly part of the greater Cambridge sub-region or whatever the current terminology is. How would localism apply in that context?
I think it needs to be on a case-by-case basis according to the location, and you're quite right to suggest, and we've got parts of Cambridge that are actually in South Cams, which is, clearly a nonsense, but there has to be some attachment to the local area, and I'm not suggesting for a minute, I don't think UKIP are as well, that if you sort of live 2 miles further out, then that probably doesn't qualify you. But prioritising people that live in Cambridge or Greater Cambridge or Cambridgeshire over people that live in Manchester when it comes to housing, I think makes an awful lot of sense. But also, of course, prioritising ex-servicemen who have given much for their country and find themselves moving every 3 to 5 years, never in a place long enough to put their roots down to be on any sort of waiting list. UKIP wish to give them some positive discrimination in this area, and I welcome that.
You've talked very openly in your blog about your reasons for moving to UKIP, and you've talked both there and you've mentioned in the studio today this phrase about protecting our way of life. Now, is it unfair of me to ask what that actually means? How do you, as an individual or UKIP as a party, define that? Because it's a very convenient phrase to trot out, but protect our way of life? What does it really mean?
Yeah, I think you're right. It is very difficult. But what people are concerned about at the moment is that the pace of change has been huge. When you get a population growth in the sort of numbers that we've seen recently, things can change. They must change because people bring with them their own characteristics, their own cultures, and that's quite normal. We've gone through a period where different cultures have been celebrated, but almost celebrated in the wrong way. Rather than sort of trying to bind people together in the British way, when people come to live in Britain, it's been cultures have been allowed to almost fight against what is innately British. And I say we could struggle to define that, I'm sure. But the status quo, the way that people have lived for tens, hundreds of years almost, and the multicultural approach has actually ended up becoming divisive, where people have ended up having subcultures within the greater culture, and sometimes they've cut across what it is to be British. And I think UKIP are really just saying that the British culture, such that it is, as to be defined, is the one that should take precedence. So we have one set of laws in this country, and they should be the one set of laws that we have. And where you have other cultural laws that are still valid and applicable to those cultures, that's fine, but they mustn't then override the law of the land.
You've talked about your frustration with having been a member of one of the mainstream parties, and that's a frustration that a lot of the electorate are struggling with, and there's this general sense of disaffection with mainstream politics. And you've also been very open talking to me about your reasons for moving. I am curious to know how someone who is as experienced a political operator as you can sign up to a party which has some fairly strange people and some out there policies associated with it. Now, I'll give you some examples, and you could pick them off one by one and tell me why I'm wrong. But
or I could just challenge you that you're falling into a bit of a cliche in your own right on this one.
Okay, well, let's give it a go and see. So, UKIP in the manifesto effectively denies the existence of man-made climate change because you want to reverse the 2008 Climate Change Act. And that flies in the face of what is a pretty strong scientific consensus now about what's going on there.
I'm not sure it's concluding that at all. Because you reject the Climate Change Act, doesn't mean it's necessarily denying it's man-made. But what it is saying is that there are consequences, political consequences, for the people of this country when you decide to make carbon the most important thing. Now, there are arguments that say that the climate has changed forever, whether it's man-made or not. And in some senses, whether it's man-made or not is probably irrelevant. What we need to be doing is working out ways of adapting to it. I mean, look, the biggest challenge that this country and the world face at the moment is actually overpopulation. There's just too many people on this planet. We haven't got any natural predators anymore, and we're growing in terms of world population all the time, and that's going to have a consequence. So I wouldn't necessarily link the climate change, man-made climate change denial, to the whole party. There are a number of us who are sceptical about it anyway, but it's much more about making sure that we in the West and other countries that are technically advanced have the tools at their disposal to help to adapt. And adaption is the key to all this, not necessarily mitigating. Because if you listen to some people, they will say we're past the tipping point, you know, despite temperatures not actually rising very much. But let's assume we are at or beyond the tipping point. Then, you know, the sensible person would say, well, let's not try and crawl back up the cliff as we're falling off it. Let's make sure we put the right things to land on when we get down there. And simple things like, you know, stopping building on floodplains would be a sensible mitigation strategy. Making sure that the Environment Agency is funded sufficiently to clean out all the drains and the dikes so we don't see what happened down in Somerset. These sort of simple things.
The Somerset floods of last year. Now, that provoked a famous bit of misspeaking by a UKIP councillor who suggested that the floods may be a form of divine dissatisfaction with gay marriage. Now, I know the councillor who said that was removed from the party, but there does seem to be a fairly steady flow of these kinds of mispronouncement, shall we say.
Would you like me to swap them and show you all the ones that the Conservatives have done?
No,
that's not the point, is it? Look, UKIP is a small, new party. Small, new parties, as they grow, mature, and attract people then who have the gravitas to take it forward to the next level. I have joined UKIP, and I want to put my shoulder to the wheel, to answer your original question, to help cement that feeling that UKIP is full of sensible, well thought through people. Do we still end up attracting people that we may not necessarily want? Of course we do. But I can tell you now, the Conservatives have exactly the same problem. And I'm absolutely certain Labour do as well. And I tell you what, I'm sure the Greens have more than their share of people. So what you can't, you mustn't mix up individuals with policies. One of the things I hear back at me sometimes is, you're being unfair to migrants. Now, no one is suggesting anything other than welcoming migrants. What we're suggesting is that the policy for the number of migrants is wrong.
And what do you think about a leader who gets involved in a discussion of what may or may not be ostentatious breastfeeding?
Look, Nigel is doing a fantastic job. Okay, he's you know, this is not about me giving a party political broadcast for him, but what a guy! He's got the charisma and the impact to make this whole country stand up and listen to him. And to do that, sometimes he's got to be controversial. I've done it myself. You know, sometimes when I was leading the council, things weren't quite going well, and I would just put a single controversial article on my blog. It would all go mad for a little while. The papers. And that's just normal politics about getting attention, because it is actually very hard for a small party like UKIP to be heard and the voice to be heard. It is happening now. Now, you know, Nigel could speak for himself about breastfeeding, I have to say. But, you know, again, picking out isolated incidents like that misses the point about the real serious policies that have been proposed in the manifesto now and as UKIP moves forward. And there's some really serious stuff in there that other parties are just not dealing with.
All right. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us. To round things off, as you know, we've asked all of our interviewees to nominate a song to play us out. So, Nick, what have you selected?
I've selected Jerusalem, actually. It was St. George's Day this week, and I think that's a great patriotic song.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us in the Cambridge 105 election studio. And just a reminder that a full listing of all the candidates standing in the Cambridge City constituency is available on the Cambridge 105 website. And that's it for today's election studio. Next week, with just a few days to go before polling day, I'll be joined by Daniel Zeichner of the Labour Party and Liberal Democrat Dr. Julian Huppert. It should make for a fascinating conclusion to the series. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.